listen, listen, listen. God is speaking to us.
Kairos Milwaukee United Church of Christ presents Together in Light, the reflection by the Reverend Gene Randall Bodman, presented on Sunday, February 25th, 2024.
Please pray with me. Holy One, be in the words of my mouth and the meditation of all of our hearts, for surely you are our rock and our salvation. Amen. Many years ago now, I was swimming in the lake in Maine that I've told you so much about with my mother-in-law. My mother-in-law was a true New Englander, and she jumped into that cold, spring-fed lake on all but the rainiest and windiest of days. But I noticed that she never put her face in the water, and she never went all the way under. I knew how much she loved swimming because she told me. She and her brothers had told me stories of growing up on Cape Cod and swimming in the salty Atlantic and in the freshwater pond near their house. So I asked her about this swimming habit one day, and she said, "Oh, I used to love it. But when I first came up to Maine and I first swam in cat ants, I got a terrible ear infection. And the doctor gave me drops for it, and they hurt so much they made my eyes cross. I never want to do that again." So I said to her, "Did you tell the doctors that the medicine hurt?" And she looked at me in utter surprise and said, "No, I just figured if it hurt, that meant it was working." "How else?" "Of course," I said, "because suffering is redemptive. How else would a New England Calvinist understand the way the world works? If it hurts, it's working. If you're suffering, you're earning God's approval." Now, my mother-in-law had a lot of fun that day. She didn't mind me poking fun at her. And she had a playful spirit that moved her far beyond her Calvinist beginnings. But woven right into her, despite her playfulness, was this sense that if it hurt, it must be working, and that suffering was good for her. That conversation stuck in my mind across the many years since that day in the lake, because it's somewhat true, it's partially true, that discomfort is a byproduct of healthy growth. Anybody who runs knows that at the beginning of the season, your muscles are going to ache. And if you've learned to play a string instrument, you know that when you begin, your fingertips are going to be tender and sore. And we may know the intellectual and even emotional discomfort of stretching ourselves to new ideas that change old paradigms that we have grown to rely on. All uncomfortable, all healthy. But no one takes up running in order to have aching thighs or calves, and no one takes up the violin in order to have sore fingers. In the same way, it is true that a faithful life, following the teaching of Jesus and attentive to the voice of the Spirit, will often be a life that includes suffering. But the suffering is not the goal or the point, or even the price that we have to pay for intimacy with the Spirit. It's easy to spot the silliness of the idea that if the medicine hurts, it must be working. But the idea that suffering is salvific is stubbornly persistent throughout Christian history. Now, it may be that none of you were infected with that particular bad seed when you were coming up, so I may be preaching to myself, but it's a sermon I needed to hear. It's true that some people make sense out of the suffering that comes to them in the course of a normal human life by choosing not to rail at it, not to become consumed by anger or bitterness, but instead to allow their suffering to make them more compassionate to other people. And in that way, offering it up to God, a phrase that I know many of us heard as children. But this seems to me to be a healthy way to allow suffering to open us to other people, to use what has happened for good. That can be a beautiful path. But there is a more insidious message that I suspect many of us may have absorbed somewhere along the way in our spiritual formation. The idea that God both wants and requires both Christ's suffering and our own. We find a kind of proof text for that idea here in today's gospel reading. It is necessary for the Son of Man to undergo great suffering and rejection and to be killed. If any wish to come after me, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. If you want to save your life, you will lose it. Those who lose their life for my sake and the gospel will save it. In this brief reading, we move from Peter's understanding to his confusion, from being sworn to secrecy about Jesus' identity to hearing Jesus speak quite openly, from suffering to death to resurrection, to the instruction to take up one's own cross. Today's reading holds the heart of the gospel and also the seed of centuries of destructive interpretation. During this season of Lent, as we focus on the road to the cross, our readings move us quickly to this first so-called passion prediction. After Peter has identified Jesus as the Messiah, Jesus immediately began teaching what that meant, that he would suffer and be rejected and be killed, and also that he would rise. Hold on to that last phrase. We sometimes forget that the point is the rising, not the suffering that comes before it. Now, none of this was what the disciples expected in a Messiah. They were people living under the heavy hand of Rome at a time when pressure was growing on the temple leadership to capitulate to the cult of the emperor, a time when taxes were ensuring that money flowed outward toward Rome and poor people were kept poor. These were people who longed for a Messiah who would lead them out from under that oppression, whatever it took. Instead, this Messiah, Jesus, taught them that his messiahship would include rejection and suffering and death, and that if they wanted to follow him, they'd have to take up their own crosses. It's good to pause and remember that the Gospels were written retrospectively, after all of the events had happened and all of the experiences the first followers had with Jesus in his life and Jesus after his death and resurrection. They wrote to make sense of what was happening to them in that moment. And the texts were later interpreted to make sense of what was happening in each era. The early church made sense of the persecution they faced by making martyrdom not a tragedy, but a marker of holiness. From honoring people who refused to deny their allegiance to Christianity, they moved to glorifying and almost fetishizing it, so that to be martyred was the most holy way to be Christian, so that some people began to seek their own martyrdom as proof of their holiness. To my ears, and I hope to yours, this seems to me to narrow and distort the whole story of Jesus into his tortured death. In another episode of Entirely Missing the Point that stands out to my nerdy historical mind, from the 12th to the 14th centuries, a new movement of so-called soldier monks called on faithful men to take the cross, to take up their own cross and join their order. After the First Crusade, when Jerusalem was in Christian hands again, there was a huge increase in pilgrimage to the Holy Land. So the poor fellow soldiers of Christ and the Temple of Solomon, more commonly known as the Knights Templar, were sanctioned by the Pope, one of several military orders sanctioned by the Pope. Soldier monks. The Templars' first assignment and their ostensible reason for existing was to protect the pilgrims who were on their way to the Holy Land. Well, that seems innocent. You're just defending innocent pilgrims. That's how it began. Soon after founding, their work expanded into fighting the Crusades themselves against Muslims in Palestine and then against heretics, other Christians in Europe. At the height of crusading fervor, preachers would move from town to town, rousing male listeners to take the cross with the promise that if they died in battle, they would receive plenary indulgence, meaning all of the temporal punishment in purgatory for their sins would be taken away. Take up the cross, come die, and you will receive benefit. And hundreds did it, grabbing the pieces of red fabric that were offered and pinning them to their shirts, the famous red Templar cross. From submitting to physical suffering and death in martyrdom to being willing to kill the so-called infidel and heretic, taking up the cross has a very shady history. And then, of course, there are the more mundane examples, examples of teaching across the Christian spectrum, from Catholic to Puritan to the progressive church, that laud individual suffering as valuable, especially the suffering of the poor and the socially marginalized, and women. I can't tell you the number of women who have come to me over the years and told me that earlier in their life, a pastor told them to stay with an abusive spouse and offer their suffering to Christ. The cross, I'm sorry, I have to gather myself after that. The cross and the empty tomb, Good Friday and Easter Sunday, are at the heart of our Christian faith. It is after their experience of the risen Christ that the early Christians wrote the Gospels to tell these stories that they knew. Everything that they wrote was in light of their experiences. We may not, from their writing and from our own experience, be able to understand the whole mystery of the cross and the resurrection, but we can approach it in many different ways without having to valorize the suffering. We can understand the cross as the heart of our faith because it is there that Jesus shows us love and mercy, even unto death. We can grasp the mystery of the resurrection as a statement of God's defeat of death-dealing forces. Perhaps we understand that Jesus subversively transforms some of the worst of life, betrayal by one's friends, the Roman cross. He transforms them into some of the best of life, a tree that gives life and resurrection and forgiveness among enemies. And in that way, Jesus proclaims, and the cross and resurrection proclaim, that God will redeem everything in the end. We may understand that the cross declares God's compassionate solidarity with all who suffer. In the words of Mary Oliver, we can allow this story to break our hearts open, never again to close to the rest of the world. One thing seems clear. We do not have to adopt the myth of redemptive violence, the idea that it is our suffering that saves us. We do not have to accept the idea that we are called to pursue suffering, the better to participate in Jesus' passion. Because Jesus' messiahship is about compassion, not conquest. And conquest is the dark underbelly of the story of redemptive suffering. Suffering does not save. God saves. And one of the things God saves us from is our violent ways, including our destructive ideas about the redemptive powers of violence and suffering, about the power of male blood in battle to save. Jesus does not call us to prolong or pursue suffering. He calls us to alleviate suffering, to end it whenever possible, and when suffering can't be avoided, to take it up and follow Jesus, the healer and liberator, into God's dawning new world of compassion for other people. Jesus makes his difficult pronouncement about taking up your cross in direct counterpoint to the conventional view of messiahship, because that is, after all, what they were discussing, what it means to be Messiah. And the conventional view was that a messiah was a military conqueror. In effect, take up your cross is meant as a contrast to vanquish your enemies, whether those enemies are military or personal or any other kind. Deny yourself is meant as a contrast to arrogate power for yourself. The conventional idea of messiahship is a self-vaunting attempt to seize advantage over others, even if that advantage is for the good of the people. The messiah has to grab power, and Jesus will have none of it. In Mark, Jesus' path is a way of humility and forgiveness, healing and liberation. It is not about grasping or vengeance, dominance or destruction. And this is the path to which he called his first hearers and to which we are called, not to seek out or glorify our own suffering, but to seek out and stand in solidarity with and alleviate the suffering of others wherever we find them. This is the cross we are to take up, moving towards the suffering. Jesus did not say, "If any of you wish to come after me, let them deny themselves and take up my cross and follow." He said, "Take up their own cross." He tells us to take up our cross, not his. To live a life that is real life, that is in participation with the divine, is to move toward those who suffer in solidarity and compassion, and to seek together a path of justice and alleviating that suffering. This is the cross we must take up individually and collectively. The artist and theologian Scott Erickson wrote this recently: "There is a strange byproduct of suffering. What occurs in the midst of human suffering is the gathering of human souls around those who are hurting. We have our resources, our skills, and technologies to offer, yes, but it seems what we most deeply need to receive and what we most deeply need to offer is the light of presence. We have the capacity to relight the spark of life in one another, the light of existence, the light that has been embedded in our very souls. And maybe that's why Jesus, the light, said, when two or more are gathered. Because in that gathering, we become aware of the shared light that we are participating with and in. Together in light, we can find a path toward justice. Gathered around those who are suffering, we share our light and receive back light. May we never lose sight of the light that shines brightest when we gather to care and to love one another, across every line of false division, beyond our fear and complacency, in the face of false news and anger and anxiety. May we gather to give and receive light with those who suffer, because the divine promises that in that moment, it will be present with us.
Listen, listen, listen.